You're listening to the Net Mums podcast with me, Wendy Gollidge.
And me, Alison Perry. Coming up on this week's show...
Maternity leave is a time where you need people, and yet you can't be without them, and yet you can't be with them either. It's an exercise in unfinished sentences, unfinished thoughts, and sheer need for other people.
But before all of that...
Welcome back, everyone, to another episode. Wendy, how are you doing today?
Well, I'm feeling a bit cheated, actually.
Ooh,
today.
Why?
So I had a friend over this weekend, and her kids are 4 and 6, so they're quite little. And she's in the Bluey phase. She's fully in the world of Bluey. And because my kids were a bit older, I missed out on Bluey. And instead, we had Pepper, the pain in my neck pig. And I'm feeling like I've actually missed a really significant phase of popular culture, in that I've never watched an episode of Bluey. All I had was the Quack Pig, as she was lovingly known in our house, because she was so addictive that the tantrums. So I'm feeling a bit sad,
but
honestly.
Wendy, I do get it, because my 6-year-olds love watching Bluey, and I love watching it too, but there's nothing stopping you. Just head on to like BBC iPlayer or whatever it's on.
Do you not think that that's a line crossing?
No.
That line of sitting and watching Bluey all by myself might mean I've finally lost it.
It is so good. And actually, you just reminded me, what about the news that Mummy Pig is pregnant? Have you heard this?
What?
Yes.
Mummy Pig. That means she had sex with Daddy Pig. That's just
no. But what I'm kind of really interested in is, so I think Peppa Pig is about 20 years old, which means I think Mummy Pig must be in her 50s. So I'm quite concerned.
So Peppa Pig's really mean to George. So what's she going to be like to a baby? Anyway, we're getting ahead of ourselves. Introduced our guest because she is basically journalistic royalty and I'm really excited.
She is. I'm excited / nervous. Today's guest is Emma Barnett, the award-winning broadcaster, journalist and presenter of BBC Radio 4's Today programme. She's also well known for presenting Women's Hour and Newsnight. And Wendy, no pressure, she was named Interviewer of the Year at the British Journalism Awards a couple of years ago. So I think we need to up our game today. Emma is also a mum of two, and her new book, Maternity Service, is a celebration and acknowledgement of what maternity leave is really like. Emma, a warm welcome to the Net Mums podcast.
Well, I'm very grateful to be here. I did hear about Peppa Pig and the third child on the way. And so it's I've got to be across the news of all levels. Thank you very much.
Let's jump straight in and not mess about, Emma. You think we need to rebrand maternity leave, don't you?
I do. And I don't mean I'm going to do a campaign to actually rename it and sort of go that way, but more because I think the reframing of it would be really helpful. And I found it helpful, and others I've spoken to found it helpful. And the biggest celebration on my second tour of duty, as I like to call it, loving duty, was that I had this original thought. You know, to have a thought at all while you're in the sleep-deprived trenches is great, but to have a thought about what you're in is, or to even have an original thought, it doesn't have to be about what you're in, it just delighted me. And then I did this quite crazed thing where my husband went on a work trip, or a course rather, for the week, I should say. It was a heat wave. I was doing pickups of our older child, looking after our baby at this point, just about 6 months old. And I decided around naps and pickups, any time I got, I would snatch it and try and write down what I thought at this time, which has resulted in a mercilessly short book, a mercifully short book, I should say, for women who are short of time. But I, in the middle of it, started thinking about service. And I think service, it's really helped me to, because service is something, you know, another word for it is kindness, another word for it is duty. There's love baked into service. And I really didn't know what to expect before my first experience. And I feel even for my second experience, I'd slightly rewritten it already in my mind. You know, the rose-tinted glasses had descended. I then obviously had all the mixed emotions about going back to work. And I just kept notes walking around the park, little observations. And then this thought came to me. And I just feel it would really help when those moments come, which they regularly do, and you can change your feelings like the weather on maternity service, of when it's hard, kind of digging deep. And I don't think your maternity service or your maternity leave ends if or when you go back to work. It's just a start. It keeps going. And I think you're building something and you're doing something amazing. And it just started to help me. And I thought, what if I could put that together in a form of words?
I know that personally, before I had maternity leave, I had visions of popping my baby in the pram and walking through the sunshine to meet friends for a coffee. And instead, I felt like I was very lonely and most of the time a very sweaty mess. And what were your own maternity leaves like in comparison to what your preconceived ideas had been before your first child?
Well, I think way back when I also thought that, but then because I had to go on another tour of duty. Yeah, totally. And there are cafes involved. For those who haven't done it, they do see these things. And there are also pubs involved very much in my first one, where there wasn't a pickup to be done of another child, where you had to be, in my case, sober to drive a car. But I think I had this other moment because I had to go on a whole other tour, if you like, horrific tour of IVF before I could get pregnant both times. And if I'm honest, by the time I got to pregnancy, I didn't believe I'd get to birth. And by the time I got to birth, I felt like, you know, all my expectations had kind of gone out the window because I needed to just get to that point. And I had to rebuild from there on in. And I think the first time I had a baby, I just left work, honestly, 5 minutes before. I swear to God, I came to the most screeching halt. And it was like one life ended and another life began. I mean, quite literally. So I had exactly, Alison, the same expectations. And then they went out the window because I didn't know if I'd even have a baby. Then they sort of came back into view. And I remember, I mean, there was a terrible nickname for me at school that I loved sharing because I'll always take the mick out of myself. I'm a Mancunian. It's just part of who we are. But I was called by one of my friends Commitment Carol. And that's because I absolutely loved getting involved with whatever was going on and just, you know, generally very curious. So I remember two weeks before I was to give birth and I'd finally accepted I was going to have a baby because for the first sort of honestly 8 months, I would just be like, nah, we'll see. Everyone was like, okay. But you know, I think that's sort of the trauma of not being able to get pregnant. And when I finally accepted it, I saw my friend who was sort of 3 or 4 weeks ahead of me. And the other thing is you make new allies if you're lucky on this journey. You only need one or two, but I just met this woman quite recently and we didn't know each other very well. We'd gone to pregnancy yoga where I'm terrible at yoga, but I sat there and did the breathing. And I said to her, what's it like? Because I think she was 3 or 4 weeks into it. What classes are you going to? What things are you at? I've looked at this app called Hoop. I've written down on Tuesdays, there's the... And she looked at me from the other side of the world. That's how it felt. And was like, I'm not going anywhere. And I just was like, what? We can do this. And to be fair, of the group I then did assemble or was part of, because my first tour, I would say I was really lucky because I had NCT and I made a bit of a band of sisters, whereas the second one was much lonelier because I couldn't, we had to have 6 rounds of IVF and I missed when other people managed to have their second. So that's a whole other thing. But I did still have a couple of women and my God, they knew they were on maternity leave with me because I'd be coming up with things for us to do if I could muster up the energy. But I did get everybody to go to their first class sort of 7 weeks in. But it was very different to how I thought. And I was like you, sweating. I had a baby that would not stop moving, would not stop pooing. I just didn't know what the next thing was going to be. You know, that internal track and monologue, I had no idea. And I was physically harmed. You know, I was very ill after the C-section I'd had to have. And, you know, no other job or role do you start injured. Not really.
So true. One of my consultants said to me, not the consultant, sorry, it must have been the midwife. I was laying in the bed in the recovery ward and she said to me, in any other situation in the world, if you had lost this much blood, even if you were on the battlefield, you'd be given a blood transfusion. But it's birth, so you don't get one.
Gosh, did you not?
No. You just have to eat some steak. Yeah. And replenish your iron. And she was really honest about it. She was like, rest, because anywhere else you'd get a blood transfusion, but here you won't.
Yeah, it's a pretty, you know, there's a lot of luck, or however you want to view it, involved in how you begin maternity leave and how that starts. And you've then got to regroup. And in my first maternity leave, I do have a partner. He is a man. He had 2 weeks. And then I remember waving him off, standing at the door, feeling like it was World War II or something within my body.
Yeah.
And that, you know, we've been together since uni. And that was the first time, you know, we were really in a different space to one another after what was meant to be and is a joint initiative.
It's bonkers. When I think back to that moment that I experienced, I was just like, you know, like, come back. Like,
you had two.
No, but when I think, first time round, when my teenager was born, I was like, I'm not ready to be left alone in a house by myself with this newborn baby. This is not happening. But why do you think, Emma, that so much of motherhood is romanticized? Like, before we, you know, have our first baby, we all have this beautiful vision of what it's going to be like. And then for most of us, it is quite different, like as you've just described.
I mean, I was talking about this and thinking about this yesterday. Perhaps it's protection. You know, the people you hear about it from are often your own parents or older people, and they love you and they don't want to perhaps say anything against you and that experience. You know, my mum said it was amazing. It was just amazing. I was like, what, all of it? You know, and I know who I am and what I do for a living means I'm essentially putting maternity leave on trial here. You know, I'm holding it to account as an experience. I'm trying to remember it faithfully and I'm trying to prosecute it almost because I felt so underprepared. So there wasn't just my mum saying all of it was amazing. You were amazing. It's amazing. Even though her birth was hard and she had been honest, to be fair, about that. So I think there's that. And I think in the book, I quote the French author Leila Slimani, who said, women, we just keep lying to each other. Generations, but it's a loving lie. It's imbued with love, and you don't want to seem disloyal to your baby, you know, and there's this whole other thing which I really want to speak against, which is this group of women who now seem to be blaming other women for being too honest, for putting other women off having children. I just simply don't buy it. You can rarely influence someone out of their own choice. Rarely, you know, that's where the Let Them movement from Mel Robbins has come from. That's where, you know, learning to influence people or talk to them, fair enough. But our demographic problem in this country and around the world is not coming from women being honest. So I think the idea that we've got to shame women for saying the greys of it, the lows of it, the highs of it, you know, women still clamour to say, I love my baby. But, well, we know you love your baby. We do. Might not happen straight away. That's another myth. But I think I think it's protection. I think it's love. And I think it's rose-tinted glasses, which are well-intentioned. And I think also it's nature. Our brains are changing and we're programmed to keep going and to survive and want something to be good. But we have flattened women's experience for so long into quite a one-note thing.
But you start the book with a note about how it's also nature that our brains are programmed to forget. You mentioned earlier that you'd kind of rose-tinted it by the time you had your second maternity leave. Why do you, like, we all do it, don't we? We all kind of rose-tint the second one and think, oh, it won't be as bad. And we kind of forget, don't we?
Yes, I think it's loving forgetfulness. And also it's a highlights reel in your own mind. You know, I made an album of that first year and there are some absolute crackers in there. Don't get me wrong. You know, after I've caught a poo in a bread bag and after I've done various other maneuvers. And I can see I'm sweating, to Alison's point, in quite a lot of the, I had both of my children in the depths of winter. You shouldn't be sweating. But you're sweating because you're breastfeeding.
Constantly.
You're thirsty. You're doing loads of things. There's kits that I don't know how to use. And you get through it. And it's a bit like anything. You look back on it and you're like, oh, okay. You know, there's a sort of pride and there might be a wistfulness about parts of it, but the way we tell our stories to each other and to ourselves is with a positive bent. That is often how we are programmed. I am in the business of helping people tell their stories, and being specific is hard, and saying things that were difficult makes other people feel uncomfortable, including ourselves.
Well, this is it, right? How much of the problem do you think is this thing that we do of saying I'm fine when we're asked how we are? Do you think that we need to be more honest, or do people actually want to know how we are as a new mum, or does it just make them feel uncomfortable?
Well, there's the enjoy every second brigade that I do talk about as well in the book, which is hard because I remember one of the women who said that to me really wanted to say something nice, you know, and so it was kind. But that is a pressure. I think there needs to be more room in that answer. And because very quickly people will say, well, you're a bit, you've got the baby blues or you're depressed. And I think there's something else between, you know, do we really want to know the answer? If you're with the baby, probably not. They just want to look at the baby or talk to the baby. You know, like, probably not, but certain people will. And then if you find your people, you know, one of the people I spoke to a lot about motherhood was a former colleague of mine at the Telegraph when we were both at a newspaper world, Lucy Jones. And we both together discovered matrescence. We'd never heard this word, this, like adolescence, the process of becoming a mother. And she's gone on, I joke, she timed her book. I said, please, will you look into this? But she wrote a book that was in time for this maternity leave for me. And I said, thank you very much. That's very helpful. And
Thank you.
Took it around with me in my nappy bag and could only read here and there and, you know, not much time to think for myself. Although you have acres of it walking and just, you know, roaming the streets.
Like audio books are the way forward, aren't they?
Yes, I think they are. And I didn't do enough of that because I work in audio. I think I try and, but a book would have been good. You're right. I should have done that. But matrescence explained a lot for me, especially on my first tour. I feel it explained how my brain was changing. And I think a lot of mothers would benefit just even knowing that your brain, there are studies to show that your brain changes. Yeah. And that's okay. Yeah, it doesn't mean it's easy.
And also the fact that you know, I haven't read the book about matrescence, but I think that it lasts quite a few years, doesn't it? It's not a case of, oh, your child's two, so you're back to normal. Like my twins are six, and I feel like it's only in the last year that I have come out of that, you know, the real being in the trenches period of parenting.
Yeah, and also just because you may have gone back to work or have more work on, I find the switch still between, you know, I've got to do this job for the home and this job for work, and just the sort of, you know, even the balancing of some of that stuff away from how you might be feeling is still really hard for a long time. And you're right, I think it can last 6 or 7 years.
Yeah.
I totally agree with it when you talk about maternity leave as being largely unpaid work. You're putting a shift in. What, in your eyes, needs to change in terms of support for new parents within that mindset?
Well, firstly, I would just say, I think a big step forward would be women being better prepared for what it would be like. So that is what I'm hoping to contribute, in the sense of when expectations are not met, you can feel even worse. So when you really don't understand, if you've not been around any babies, I've never been around any babies, like obviously in family circles, but I hadn't been close to a baby. So all of that was new, and a bit like what Alison was saying, I kind of thought I was having a bit of a break and I was going to just frolic about with some new folks and fall in love with my baby, and all of that would feel like my regular life. So I do think as much preparation as possible, that you can't really hear it till it happens, but knowing that there are times ahead that you won't recognise yourself and you won't recognise the world that you find yourself in. I had a message from a mother the other day. She's got a 5-month-old and her husband has sent her to a cafe, and she'd read an article about, linked to the book coming out, and she wrote to me and she said, you probably won't see this, and I was happy I did, but she said, everyone says it's going to get better and I'm waiting for it to get better, but it's not getting better. And I was like, it might not get better, but you'll get used to it. It will change. I felt like at least I could say that to her. So I think knowing that you can talk about that and being prepared. I mean, structurally, the shared parental leave hasn't worked, you know, on a political level. The numbers, by definition, the take-up numbers means it's a failed policy.
Yeah.
So I do think how you can share the load, especially when you're injured in the first few weeks, really needs to be addressed. Not by me. This isn't a political book. I interview sometimes, a lot of the time, for people who make the decisions. But we need a policy that works for this country. We need to stop hankering after what the Scandinavians are doing, or keep saying it works. Yeah, although they've got the Swedish soft girl trend on the rise over there, which is women without children glamorizing having a soft life and being and having an allowance from their boyfriend.
Oh, I have heard about this, yes.
So let's not, you know, my mother-in-law's Swedish. I've got a lot of respect for the Swedes, but they haven't got everything right. And we've got, you know, we've got a good history in this country of innovation when we get to thinking about things. We don't always get there very fast, but I'd love for that to work a bit better. And I do think NCT, of course, plays a role. That was the particular one I went to. There are other groups available. But I do think it would be amazing for there to be more accessible, better community-focused things where you could prepare and get into zone and then meet other people once you're done. And there are initiatives, I know, but I do think support basically needs to be there. And that the other main thing that I also think is postnatal care would give women a much better start.
And if you could just redesign maternity and paternity leave rights from scratch, I mean, you know, you're saying let's not necessarily do a carbon copy of what Sweden have. If you could do anything, what would it look like?
In some ways, you know, there are people much better placed than me to answer that question in that sort of way. But what I would say is, I do think if there was just a way, and this is very pie in the sky thinking, of having more of a structure around it, that, you know, there was this sort of class on a Monday, there was this sort of initiative on a Wednesday, like a kind of almost a national curriculum for not, and also for helping you once the baby is here. You know, a lot of the advice comes before the baby. It to learn, to have community, and to take people in who feel really lonely, women who feel alone. I would love that. You know, I miss the structure of education and school and things that can look after you. And if there was a way of having that, there are things in your local library if you're lucky. But if there was just a bit more, I'd love that.
I actually think that for me really taps into what I felt. Because often with your first baby, you stop work a week before your baby comes. And your society and your everything that you do is often really, as a woman, based around what you're doing at work. I was a journalist. I had lots of friends. I did lots of stuff at work. And suddenly I was back, I was living in the suburbs with a baby and I didn't know anybody. And it was, the onus is on you to find those things to do and go and meet people. And there's no structure around how you do that. And so I felt like a fish just flailing around, not knowing where to go. And one of my editors had said, oh, it's just watch maternity leave is watching Murder, She Wrote on the sofa with your baby. And it was, I just kept thinking, it's not this. She won't let me do anything. What do I do? So I think you're right. That structure, that kind of path to follow would make it so much easier.
Yeah, I think that would really help, especially because people often move out or they change their living arrangement or something changes around that time to have more space maybe. So, but of course, I also think more support, you know, the shared side of it, if you have a partner, is key. But yes, something that got you beyond the 6 week GP appointment and the house visit that happens. You know, there's like two other things and then you're alone.
Yeah. Or one in my case, because the second one just didn't show up.
Oh, I had, yeah, like the second time around.
They're just like ticking boxes, aren't they, and sending you on your way.
And then you have to go to those weigh-in clinics where someone's like, they basically you get told off. If you're not breastfeeding, you get told off. If your baby's too light, you get told off. If they're too heavy, you get told off. If their poo's the wrong colour, you get told off. Yes. And everyone's there comparing, and that's where you meet the first woman. Oh, little so-and-so is already sleeping through the night.
Exactly.
That's
There's a story in the book about this. I tried to really, you know, you both can understand this, like, be specific, right? You know, in how important it is when you write and you share something. And the minutiae of maternity leave service, if you're on board with my name for it, for me, I had to not lose sight of that. So when I reread it the other day, I'd completely already forgotten that I couldn't wear my wedding ring the whole way through my maternity leave. Now, I know that's a small detail, but my hands had swollen so much in my second pregnancy. And it really upset me every day. Like, you look at your hands a lot during maternity leave. You're washing them, you're changing nappies. You know, for me, I used to like having the occasional manicure. That was out of the window because I was doing all this stuff with my hands. My life became very manual, you know, in a way that as a journalist, it just hadn't been, okay? Or as a broadcaster, my hands were literally getting dirty. And it upset me every day that a ring that I'd worn for 10 years that I happened to really like, it was my grandmother's ring, I could no longer wear it. So even that was just not there. And it really upset me. I'd completely forgotten that. And you fixate on things because you're in the domestic. It's like when you stay in for too long and you look at all the mess, you just need to go out, you know? Well, that was certainly how I felt. And then I tell this story as well about going to meet my cousin, and the thought that had to go into going to town, into going into London, going on the tube, because I knew that my lift, my local tube was broken. So then being able to flex it so I could get into the next tube, you know, I was kind of, it was like a military operation to make sure we got there. We managed to get there on time. And the entire time I was there, our daughter was just sick the whole time, burping up. I was covered in it. She was crying a lot. I could barely hear my cousin. She was thrilled she got to see the baby. The baby then burped up on her, you know, and it basically nearly wasn't worth it. But at the same time, if I hadn't gone that morning, I would have just sat on the sofa and watched, at the time, the morning show, which I was so involved with, I actually thought I worked on it. And then I did go and say yes to working on the Today programme not long after. So I don't know how influential that was. But, like, I really thought I worked with Jennifer Aniston for a while. That's how sleep deprived I was. But I tell that story because maternity leave is a time where you need people, and yet and you can't be without them, and yet you can't be with them either. It's an exercise in unfinished sentences, unfinished thoughts, and sheer need for other people.
Yeah, that's so true. Now, you've mentioned already that you had IVF to conceive both of your children. I went through the similar experience to have my twins, so I know how hard it is, how relentless it feels. What do you think, looking back, was the hardest part of that part of your experience?
Yes, I had one round for my son, but I'd been trying for 2.5 years, didn't know I had endometriosis and adenomyosis. So that was that. And we had this one round at the end of that hellish 2.5 years, and we got pregnant. And it was just, wow. And it was on the NHS, and that was my round. And so when we came to trying for our daughter, as she became, I went in full of hope. And hope is the stuff that will kill you. And I foolishly thought, it's worked before, it will work again. And that first round, there were two points that were the hardest. So the first round failing hit me like a train, you know, because, well, that didn't happen last time. And I know the odds, but actually I respond well to treatment. And so that was really, really hard. And then lockdown began. And all my next five rounds after that, I had to do alone. So my husband wasn't allowed to come to any of the transfers. And that made it a very intense experience with my doctor. And I stayed in the NHS. I paid because I'd had my free round. But it's that kind of stick or twist moment. Do I go over somewhere else? And I was like, I'm going to stay with this team. So I found there's three parts to your answer. The first one failing, having to do it alone in that way, was very unique to lockdown, and, you know, in a mask and everything being even more sort of medical and sort of a bit scary. And then the miscarriage on round five, I raged. And again, the journalist analytical person part of me knows the odds. I know that once you become pregnant through IVF, you join the general population of women who conceive. I know then one in four pregnancies end in a miscarriage. But I stupidly went to this an extra scan because I felt unwell on my own. And I can't relive easily the moment I was told there was no heartbeat. But it wasn't allowed after that number of IVF rounds for me to lose a baby. You know, I just, the injustice of it on top of the grief, because I didn't know if I would go again. I didn't know if I could go again. I didn't know. But it was the first round that had worked since our son. And my doctor friend, who was having IVF at the same time, she did eight rounds to my six. We went for a walk. And this is why having someone when you're in a tough spot who ideally has either been through the same thing or is going through the same thing is so important. And we were like IVF fairies for each other, or sisters in arms and all of that. We went for a walk and she said, "This is great." I was like, no, it's not great. Nothing about this is great. She went, "No, because you got pregnant." She could see that something had worked. And I was like, "I'm not doing it again. This is horrific. I can't go back in the ring. The gamble is over. It's five rounds. It's 2 years of my life. No." And she was like, "If you don't, you will regret it. You have to try again." And I think I almost said yes to make her feel better. And then I went and bloody did it. And we had, we genuinely, she did do a bit of I told you so. I mean, thank God she could. And I am the luckiest.
And did she succeed? Did she get there with her eight rounds?
So she had a miscarriage on the same round as me. Or same, she was a bit one ahead, but the same transfer. She had a horrific time as well. And she won't mind me saying, she got pregnant on the same round and our children were born 3 days apart. Oh. And we live on the same road.
Wow.
And
meant to be.
We left pregnancy tests. She left a pregnancy test one morning for me on when you had to try and see if it had worked. This was not around which word, but she, I don't think I've ever said this before, but she left it in a flower pot for me outside her house. And I was on air at 10 o'clock in the morning. So I used to leave at 6-ish. So I ran down the road at 5 o'clock in the morning to get a pregnancy test because I hadn't bought one out of a flower pot in her on her porch at her steps to her door. And I ran back and my husband's like, where have you been? And I was like, she's left me a pregnancy test because she had a spare one. And, you know, just this crazy shit that was going on. And yeah, she was right.
So do you think this experience, this hugely all-consuming experience, has impacted the way you approach motherhood?
Well, listen, there is huge guilt for the women who will never get there. And there is, and I have done quite a few interviews and prioritised speaking and having people on my newsletter. I have a newsletter called Trying, which started about this process, but isn't just about people trying in life, which we all do every day. I stay very close to those women in my heart and I put their stories on my newsletter, on the radio, because what is your life like if you can't become a mother and you want it to be? I don't just carry guilt or a strong sense of feeling for them. I just want to remember them and think about them. That means my motherhood is laced with gratitude. I still stare at both of our children, even in a bad moment, in awe that they're here. Now, listen, everybody might feel like that, the sense of it's incredible to create, but that can lead to you then feeling like, you know, you can't have some of the natural responses to when something's hard because you're feeling so grateful. But of course I have the responses. And I've had to give myself permission to feel the feelings, you know, and have those responses. And, you know, I think it just means I'm all in. But what I would say is my hormones after that many rounds of IVF and having endometriosis and coming out of the back of breastfeeding, you know, I think I've physically and emotionally paid a high price to become a mother that I'm still grappling with.
Yeah.
Just to be very honest.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And you're very open about your experiences with endometriosis. And we know that there is a huge waiting list at the moment for any women to be seen by a doctor for women's health issues. What do you think needs to change to sort out this whole mess?
It's very, very hard because the doctors don't know anything. They actually don't. And I can say that now because I have seen 6 doctors in the last 2 years. They've got some ideas. They've got synthetic and bioidentical hormones. And you put yourself up for being a guinea pig. Either, you know, if you go for the surgical route, there's huge waiting lists. But if you get there, your hysterectomy won't be as good as the one in America because they're way ahead, I'm told.
Oh, right.
And we need to treat endometriosis like an emergency. It is not a quiet disease. It is destroying women from the inside out. Yeah. It is a global emergency. And I haven't said that in that way before, but that is what I think. And I am appalled that the same number at least suffer from this, and they suffer. And it's the same number as people who have type 2 diabetes. It might be more. I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't. And we do not have a fucking clue.
Totally agree. So I'm going to change the subject slightly because you're a busy lady. You work at the BBC. You've got a book, you've got kids, you've got a husband. But you've also set up your own business. How on earth have you got the time to do all of these things?
Well, I think you're accurate in saying that I don't. So thank you for that assessment. You are a smart woman to say that. No, I'm sitting here surrounded by these things. Piles and piles of colouring books. Yes, we set up Colour Your Streets 18 months ago, and it was a very lovely, happy accident. And I will answer your question, but it was from our son enjoying our local park, but asking us questions, and we didn't know the answers. And I thought, well, I'll just buy him a colouring book of the local area or a book. And history books exist, of course, but we started to try and draw it. And colour in Brixton, colour in Herne Hill, where we are in South East London, just didn't exist. And the answer is my husband's done it. You know, I am very involved. I have been very involved with the design. I've been involved with the editorial. I'm really excited about it. We've got more than 150 books now, and we're mapping the whole of the UK. But, you know, he's now left his job. This is his job as of January. And we have this sort of force on our hands. People love seeing where they live in colouring form. And it's actually very joyful, and we've really enjoyed it.
Colouring in itself has had a big resurgence, hasn't it? So it's kind of like you've tapped into two trends at the same time.
Yeah, and I think people, apart from their football team or politics or whatever, or their name, get really excited when they see colour in Lincoln, and there's not been a colouring book of Lincoln before, or where they live really matters. And I actually think post-COVID, you really got to know your area. I mean, you dug in. I know every centimetre of my local park because I've done 2 mat services and however many lockdowns. I think there are quite interesting parallels between lockdown and maternity service, you know, away from the seriousness of COVID. So I feel, yeah, there's joy in it. And yeah, it's a very happy accident, but it definitely adds to the chaos of our lives and our existence. At the same time, this time of life, you spend a lot of time in, you know. And actually, when my husband wasn't working on it full time, we were both doing it around our work. And although you obviously regularly, and we do, want to just crash in front of the latest thing you're watching on the sofa, and it was also counterintuitively quite good for us to have this focus and have a project. You know, there was a sort of sense of purpose to being under house arrest with small children.
Yeah. Now, it's such a cliche to ask somebody how they juggle their career with being a mum. It's a really lazy question. And as I said at the start, Wendy and I have upped our game. It might not be obvious to you, Emma, but we really have upped our game in this episode.
I'm loving it.
If you were to offer one piece of advice on balancing life, what would it be?
Somebody told me, I mean, I'm sure this has come up before. There's the Donald Winnicott thing about being a good enough mother. He was a psychoanalyst in the 50s or 60s. And I really buy into that. You know, I try to buy into that. I remember that. I think of certain phrases almost every day. Like one of my male friends, who's a dad, told me he doesn't do guilt. And I do. I've got a total degree in guilt. Before becoming a mother, I'd feel guilty if I forgot someone's birthday. You know, I have horribly high standards, and I'm sure lots of women do too, for kind of what I think I should be doing, right? I regularly think of him and then think, he says guilt is a wasted emotion. So I have these sayings or things. I think about maternity service when I'm feeding my daughter and it's going all over the floor and she doesn't want it. And then I think to myself, she won't starve if she doesn't eat the dinner tonight. Because I used to have a pathological fear with my child that he wouldn't sleep through. It's mainly about sleep. So I've got all these things going on. But the other piece of advice that I live by and try and live by is, now I have two, because I also, being an only child, I've been fascinated my whole life by siblings. I simply don't understand them. I think they are the most fascinating, odd things that you would have another person. And I've asked my husband so many questions because he has two brothers, and all my friends, they think I'm really strange about this. But now I've got a front row seat to siblings, but that also means divided attention. Yeah. And so I do 10 minutes with each of them every day of something. So even if it's just 10 minutes of colouring or 10 minutes of listening to my son read. And I honestly look at the clock, I see when it starts. I might have to wait to when my husband is then available, because he does mornings typically and I do pickups because of our schedule. I've got such a strange schedule. I have to wait sometimes for him to come down to take the little one away so I can hear my son. I'm still learning to cope with the noise of two children. I know that sounds really weird, but when you're an only child, I grew up with one-to-one conversations and quite a lot of silence, which is probably why I turned the radio on and got obsessed with that for so many years. And I do 10 minutes. And I feel in everything else, if I get to do that, I feel that the day's like an okay one.
It sounds like something I might adopt, actually, because I'm trying to juggle 13 and 9, and that's different.
Is it?
Really different. And you're trying to juggle 14 and 6,
yeah,
Alison.
I am.
And the needs are hugely different. And the 13-year-old probably needs me more.
Yeah.
So that's a really interesting take on it, actually. I think I'm going to steal your idea.
Yeah, I don't know how long that can last, but at this particular point, I feel there are two lots of activities. You know, and I really hold for my son, because he was an only child for nearly 5 years, and I can really relate to that. So I do really watch what's not happening for him that might have been happening before. And obviously he's got a whole other load of benefits by he's got a mate for life. You know, they sleep next door to each other. I know he really likes that, even though she's only two. She's got this great sort of personality, and I think the benefits obviously massively outweigh the negatives. I really feel that. But there are things where you're letting something drop, and it's just making sure, I'm trying to make sure that not too many things are dropped.
So you say that your book isn't there to offer advice for parents, and obviously there are loads of trusted places to go, like NetMums, but do you think we've reached peak advice from experts, or do you think there's always a place for help and guidance?
I do think helping, I've trawled NetMums late at night and seen things that were helpful and a different view, or someone who's done it before you. And I do love advice, I have to say. And that's why I'm not doing it in this. I'm just giving a bit of a frame and a bit of an account that you might pull something from. And there are a couple of tips in there, like playlist and a uniform, having your kit ready to go by the door in the morning. You know, there's some stuff that I did sort of end up living by when I really looked through what I'd done. A bobble always on the wrist if you've got long hair and breastfeeding and grabby babies, things like that. I mean, but as a journo, I really like advice. You can't have too much of it, but I do think we're all just trying to get through. And I really appreciate the wisdom of other people. And I actually take advice. You know, what I said before about you can't change people. I don't think you can fundamentally change a big decision like having a baby or not because someone else found it hard. But I do think you can influence people. And I think the wisdom of mothers to each other in particular, I know there are experts, is really lovely a lot of the time and helpful.
But I think there's a flip side in that I'm the kind of person who, when I was listening to Michael Mosley's podcast, Just One Thing, I didn't want to do just one thing. I wanted to do all of the things because that was, just one wasn't enough. And so when I went and listened to advice from parents, I couldn't, you're so sleep deprived. I don't think you can filter what's the right advice for you. And so I don't know. I think that I'm personally really struggle with too much advice because then I just get confused and I don't know what to do.
Yeah, when you're tired, and I say this as someone who now gets up at 3:21 for my job.
Ow!
You
3:21, that's really specific.
It's so specific. It's my rebellion, that 1 minute against the machine. I can tell you that your ability to filter gets worse throughout the day, and that's why I have to have a nap on those days. You know, I've learned the hard way. And you get upset. Of course you do. You know, so I remember this from the early days of motherhood. And I don't know, I think with a two-year-old, I'm still slightly in the early days of motherhood. I think I'm allowed to just still claim that. But, you know, I know what you mean. And I think it's very hard. For instance, we had some sleep regression and I got a lot of advice and a lot of it was contradictory. And in the end, I wrote it all down and tried to understand what might work. I did slightly go into journo mode of this matches with this, this matches with that, but that doesn't match our child. You know, it can be very overwhelming. I accept that. But that's why I also think the secondary layer of your own people going through the same thing at the same time has always been quite a good filtration system.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Emma, thank you so much for joining us today. It has been absolutely marvellous to talk to you. Yeah, thank you very much.
Thank you. I'm really excited to see what the extremely brilliant and always with an opinion women of Netmums might think of what we've had to say and the book.
Oh, they'll tell us. They'll tell us. Don't you worry. Don't forget, you can get in touch with us on all social channels, Instagram, Facebook, TikTok. Just type in Netmums and you'll find us. And if you liked what you've heard today, we'd love for you to give us a 5-star rating, press the follow button and share the podcast on all your socials.